you know, when I think going left is the correct thing and everybody else is saying right, I will fight to the end of the world to go left unless somebody convinces me otherwise, even though that means losing those relationships. Like if you build a business and if you want to be successful in life, like there are going to be people who hate you. Whenever I'm out speaking at conferences, I have this chart that says impact on the world in one axis and then a direct correlation on the other end to people pissed off. On one end, you have nobody pissed off. You're watching kittens and YouTube on your pants, right? And then the other end, you're a famous rock star and president of the earth, right? I want to be the fighter. I want to do what I think is right. And I'm not going to be loved by everyone as part of doing that. I'll have to do the best that I believe.
We stand today.
This is Method.
With a shadow.
The Business Method.
The Business Method Podcast.
The Business Method Podcast featuring Chris Reynolds. Entrepreneurs, systems, methods, tools, and tactics for location independence.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'm your host, Chris Reynolds, and welcome to the Business Method Podcast, a podcast featuring successful entrepreneurs and high-profile people dissecting their online and location-independent business models. We dissect the different methods, tools, and tactics of high-performance online entrepreneurs and high-caliber people in a series format. On our first series, we interviewed 100 entrepreneurs in 100 days that had built businesses creating $100,000 or more annually. On our second series, we are interviewing 100 entrepreneurs that have built location-independent businesses that generate $1 million or more in annual revenue. There's a growing movement of people building these caliber of businesses, and we are getting behind the minds, the logic, and the science of what it takes to build businesses like this. On top of that, we also gather entrepreneurs at events and retreats around the world. This October, we are having our annual event in Thailand, Get Shit Done Live. It's 10 days of high-performance productivity, targeted collaboration, and rapid execution designed for entrepreneurs to get a lot of work done in a little amount of time. Some say it's like 10 months of work in 10 days. There's a magic that happens when brilliant minds come together to push one another towards productive execution. That is exactly what this retreat is about. Check out all the details at thebusinessmethod.com. That is thebusinessmethod.com. Now, let's jump into today's show.
The Business Method.
Could you imagine starting and building 20 successful companies from scratch with no investments before the age of 34? On top of that, being a board member in over 20 companies in Asia, Europe, and America, graduating from MIT with a master's in business, releasing a Danish Financial Times top 5 book on entrepreneurship, and then re-releasing it in 23 different countries, and being involved in a leading financial management platform for banking and insurance that has more than 80 million monthly users and a value over $1 billion. Today's guest is that person, and his name is Mads Fauholtz. On the show today, Mads and I talk about the extensive experience he has as an incredibly motivated entrepreneur. We chat about his youth and him starting to invest in stocks on his own at the age of 11, what drives him, the importance of understanding subconscious drivers and managing those motivators. We talk about how he used the book The 4-Hour Workweek to model his life in business, what he learned at business school versus not attending business school, and the importance of measuring business models before starting new businesses. You guys, this is an incredibly smart and intelligent and extremely motivated and successful entrepreneur. I really recommend you check out this episode. And without further ado, let's jump into the show.
Entrepreneurs, systems, methods, tools, and tactics.
Mads, my friend, welcome to the show. I am very excited to have you on the mic. How are you doing today?
Fantastic, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for calling in. And you're in London today, is that right?
I am in London this very second, exactly.
Good. Is that your home base?
It is. I'm between Switzerland and London and home base, but spend probably 50% of my time in plane nowadays.
I was reading your bio earlier today, and I was shocked at some of the amazing success that you've had in your life, but also the drive that you had in your life. And, you know, you built 20 companies from scratch without investment, have a number one best-selling book. You've done some amazing things in the entrepreneurial and financial world. When I hear stories like this, the first thing that I always think of is, you know, how did this guy get his start? How did this person get their start, and where are they coming from? So I'd like to kind of just give you the mic for a couple of minutes, Mads, and kind of understand how you became the amazing entrepreneur that you are today.
I'll try my best. It's always difficult to say these things as being Danish, because, you know, coming from Denmark, we're not big self-promoters in any way and form. And if anything, you talk about your own success, you'll be shut down by others. So it's very anti-American in that sense. But I'll try my best to give you the spiel. So, okay. Originally from Denmark, grew up there. So I was very lucky. So I ended up doing TV on a Danish TV program when I was a kid. So I was almost like I had a TV program on the biggest Danish TV station, the BBC of Denmark, the biggest national TV station. I also did radio. My dad was a journalist, so we ended up doing both, slightly because of him, slightly because I applied. Did that from when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. Started doing stock investment when I was 11. I remember being in the kitchen. I had learned about stock from a blind receptionist at my dad's office who he was investing in stocks. He was told what it said in the newspaper by somebody who read it to them. And he then told me about stocks. And so I wanted to invest in stocks at 11 from the money that I earned doing TV. And I called up the bank. I said, look, can I buy stocks? And I think the amount of money I wanted to put into stocks, I think the commission would always be almost be as much as the money I was going to buy stocks for. And the guys at the other end said, look, I need to talk to your parents. And, you know, I said, sure. Gave the phone to my dad. And the guy said, well, you know, do you know your son is trying to buy stocks? And my dad says, look, I don't know what he's trying to do, but just let him do whatever he's trying to do, right? So I bought the first stocks when I was 11, which was really, really fun. Ended up day trading a bit later and then stopped investing and now started again. But that was a fun thing. I did all the things that a lot of kids do, which is I tried to build a car washing company. And, you know, I delivered newspapers and advertising to people around my house. I think I got the first real job outside of that when I was 13, which is not uncommon in Denmark. So I worked at McDonald's when I was a kid. I worked in a supermarket from when I was 13, et cetera. I still think McDonald's, by the way, was probably the toughest job I ever had. They really expect you to work when you're at work. They, you know, if you put down something with one hand, you have to take something up with the others. So I think McDonald's is a fantastic place to learn. And then when I was 16 in high school, I ended up taking a job. So first of all, I went to a English speaking high school, which was quite interesting. Nobody did that, you know, 15 years ago now. They actually had a hard time filling the classes. Now I know there's, you know, six times as many classes starting every year as when I started. And, you know, it's really popular and they have to say no to people. Back then, there weren't a lot of people. And I don't know why I wanted to do it in English. I think it was just because it was difficult, effectively. And, you know, if one thing is learning to speak English, another thing is having math in English. You know, it's difficult enough learning math in high school. And then if you add a new language to that, it becomes tremendously difficult. So it was a struggle. And I think I had my fair share of skipping classes and, you know, and talks with the principal at the school, if I should even be allowed to continue there. But somehow they let me do that. But while I was in high school, I bought quantities of products from companies that were going bankrupt. So I tried to buy this.
Very smart.
Crazy invention of stupid invention, effectively, of a Danish designer who made this special thing you could use to lift a CD-ROM. It was basically, you didn't have to touch the CD-ROM with your hand. It was basically like, I don't know what it's called, but you put it on top of the CD-ROM, so you didn't have to touch. It was a really stupid idea. But it effectively, because the company went bankrupt, it was selling for nothing. It was quite a nice design element. So I bought a bunch of those, sold them on. I bought some other clothes. I sold them onto another business. I didn't make a lot of money from it, but it was just learning, negotiating, you know, doing good deals, doing bad deals. And then I took a phone sales job, which is, if you wanted to have one takeaway and you're listening to this, this would be learn how to sell. And then, you know, the best way to learn to sell, I think, is doing phone sales. Because if you work in a store and you're selling, you may have 20 interactions a day. If you're driving to different places to sell, you may have 3 or 4 or 5 interactions a day. If you're doing phone sales, you'll have like 50, 60 interactions a day. There'll be usually somebody there to teach you how to become a better sales guy. And the whole company is focused on you becoming better at what you do. By the way, if you ever want to choose a good company to work for, I would always choose the company that has everything vested in you becoming better. I ended up working for McKinsey, a management consulting company later, which was the same thing. They're structured around you becoming better at what you do. Anyways, learned how to sell, was decently good at it, made a lot of money. I think I made $50 an hour or so. You know, this is, again, 15 years ago. I was 16 at the time. It was beside school. But because I was a good sales guy and it was it was commission based effectively or largely. Then I finished high school. At that point in time, applying for university in Denmark was really easy. You basically had to click a button. And most of the universities didn't have a minimum grade average to get in, which was really lucky for me. So I applied, not thinking that I was going to go, but just, hey, better to have applied. And then after the summer, I can decide if I wanted to or not. I said, okay, I got into the one I wanted to get into. I then went. I started at Copenhagen Business School, which is the 10,000-person business school in Denmark, studying business administration economics. When I was there, I finally found out this was fun, right? So I thought high school was boring, even though it was in English and it was business focused. I thought, elementary school was boring. I thought business school, that was fun. We had a lot of cool classes. So I did that. I continued to work more or less full time in sales beside it, ended up becoming the head of the sales team. So I had 50 people working for me. I was 18, 19 years old.
Wow.
And then I found out that you could actually finish university faster than 3 years, which was the nominated time in Denmark. Nobody had done it at the time, but I actually ended up signing up for the second and third year at the same time, doing all the classes of both years. And so I ended up finishing my bachelor's in a year and 9 months while working full time in this call center. So I would basically go to school at 8, finish usually at 2 or 4. Then I would work in this media company doing sales, or doing at that point sales leadership, from 2 or 4 till about 10 p.m. And then from 10 p.m. until I would go to bed, I would then do all the homework, read up for the next day. And then on the weekends, I would usually work and do that as well. So I can tell you the honest truth, it wasn't a lot of partying, but it was tremendous fun anyways, because it's what I love to do and wanted to do. I finished then my bachelor's when I was 20 years old, and my stepfather came to me and said, because I was about to apply for a master's, he said, where's the best place you can go in the world to study? And I immediately replied and said, Harvard Business School. I'd never been to the U.S. I didn't know enough about MPAs. I didn't know enough about master degrees. I just heard about, you know, HBS, Harvard Business School, in various, you know, medias and movies and all these kind of things. And so I then went to a bunch of events. I went to visit Harvard Business School. I went to visit other schools. And effectively ended up applying for MIT and Columbia for the MBA programs, so Sloan School of Management and Columbia University. And I remember the time that I decided I wanted to apply for MIT was actually when I was at Harvard Business School. So as some people will know, MIT and Harvard are both basically in Boston / Cambridge, so just around the corner from each other. And I was at Harvard Business School, and you follow these students around who are current MBA students at HBS. And one of them asked me, says, look, where else are you going to visit? I said, I'm going to Columbia and MIT. And they said, wow, those guys at MIT, they work hard. And I thought, well, I'm going to pay for this MBA. I had no mom who was going to pay for it. My parents didn't have money. You know, I've come from a middle class family. We weren't poor, but, you know, they didn't give me any money, to go with to school or anything. So I had to pay for it. I had to borrow money from Citibank to $150,000, whatever I ended up borrowing. And effectively, you know, I said, well, if I'm going to pay for this myself, I want to go where they work hard, because I'm sure I'm going to build more muscle from that intellectually and drive-wise. So I applied for MIT. But, you know, the average age to get in for an MBA is, I think, nowadays 28 years old, 5 years, 4 years of work experience. And I was 20 when I applied. But somehow, you know, there's a good old saying that says you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And so this was a case of me taking a shot, and, you know, I applied for Columbia at MIT. I got into MIT. I got waitlisted for Columbia and ended up joining the MBA at Sloan when I was 21, you know, around people that were 28. And I remember starting there. I thought for the first probably 6 months that they had made a mistake. I literally thought that somebody was going to come tap me on the shoulder and say, you know, it's a really common Danish name. Mm-hmm. We picked the wrong one. It was a mistake in our administration. I was so scared. Like, I still have nightmares that I didn't graduate from. I think it's actually a common nightmare to have that you didn't graduate. But I literally still have nightmares about it. But I went through it. It was a tremendous time. I ended up being TA for Stuart Myers, who had written Brief Demise Allen, which is a really famous corporate finance book that I had read when I was at Copenhagen Business School. So one of my idols ended up being TA for him. I ended up just having a tremendous time. My focus when I was there wasn't to be an entrepreneur. It was coming in. But then when I realized how crazily smart the other guys were, I actually, quite honestly, got really, really scared of it. I said, I have no idea what's going on. People reading TechCrunch, you know, I thought Silicon Valley was like literally a roundabout with buildings around it, right? I had no idea. And so I got a bit scared. So I ended up, you know, applying for consulting companies, really wanted to work for McKinsey, which is a management consulting firm. Ended up applying for the Swiss office, went there, got in, worked there for the summer, and then was offered a full-time role and went back. And I remember still when I applied for McKinsey, you have to do this case interview where you're solving a case in the meeting. So they'll ask, like, they'll say, XYZ company's thinking about going to Brazil, should they do it? And you then have to ask questions, you get data, and then you have to come up with the right conclusion. And I remember everybody in my class who wanted to go into McKinsey were practicing with each other. It was like, you know, I give you a case, I'll give you some feedback, you give me a case, I give you some feedback. But my way of always been trying to hack these situations. So just like I hacked standing out in Copenhagen Business School by being the guy who had finished the bachelor's the fastest while everybody else was fighting to have the highest grade, which is basically hack. I didn't get the highest grades and the fastest. I got much lower than the highest grades, but I was the fastest. I tried to hack how do we get into McKinsey in the smartest way. And so the way that I did that is I looked around the school. I figured out we had a bunch of people who had worked for McKinsey before. Even a lot of them had interviewed people on behalf of McKinsey. And so I went to those guys and I said, you know, look, I can, I really want to learn from you. I'll offer you dinner and I want you to do the case prep with me so that, you know, I have a higher chance of getting in. So I ended up preparing with those guys, ended up building my own framework for how to solve it. And every single chance I had, I was just solving McKinsey puzzles in my head as a way to prepare. I got in, worked for McKinsey for a bit of time, but wanted to be an entrepreneur. And then I built a online hair products website while I was working for McKinsey in Switzerland. I realized I was earning more money selling hair products online. Once you see me, Chris, you'll realize with my long blonde hair products is the most natural thing for me to do.
I saw a picture, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I look very much like a person naturally made for the Viking series, except for my body, which obviously is not, but my hair at least. And so I worked for McKinsey, had the hair products side on the side. And then I read the 4-Hour Workweek, which I'm sure a lot of the listeners have read as well. Yeah. And I said, wow, you know, working so much is the stupidest thing ever. I became very arrogant about the fact that people shouldn't work that much. I explained to him, well, look, you're an idiot if you work that much. You know, who's that stupid? All those things. I'll tell you, Chris, I work a lot more today than I did at McKinsey. So, you know, life is ironic sometimes. But what I realized, it wasn't about working. It was about having fun. Yeah. And I have a tremendous amount of fun today. So I'll fast forward a bit. So I jumped out to do that. In the process, got headhunted to work for a media company. It was an incredible package and it was an incredible role. The company was about to go bankrupt, but they were doing a big turnaround on it. I wanted to be part of it. I was in Germany. So it was actually Europe's biggest TV company at the time. And I went there. And as a result of being in that company, I got to meet a quite infamous or famous German entrepreneur called Oliver Samwer, who has founded a business called Rocket Internet and Zalando and a bunch of other businesses. Very well known for building Groupon internationally, Zalando, which is the biggest European e-commerce company, okay, et cetera, et cetera. And Oliver at the time had just merged the business with Groupon and was actually in charge of Groupon everywhere but the US. And so he said to me, I was 25 years old, said, look, come and work for me. I can't tell you what you're going to do. I said, that sounds like a no-brainer. You know, he said, I'm going to pay you 60% less than you got paid before. So it sounds even better. Then he said, fly to Japan. I flew to Japan. I worked my fucking ass off. I worked 6.5 days per week. I don't think I ever finished before 2 a.m. I don't think I was ever later in the office in Japan before 8 a.m. A month passed and I was the CEO of Japan. Another month passed and I was the CEO of Asia for Groupon. At that point in time, I was 25 years old. I had 3,500 people roughly working for me and you know, 40 for the people who worked for me. And I ended up getting paid a base salary of $1 million a year, $1 million, 25 years old. It's just, I couldn't even invent this if I had to. And then, you know, we did that. We IPO'd Groupon. I didn't IPO it. I was just minding my business and doing the best I could. And then Oliver, who had put me there, he had a bunch of other businesses. So I built companies with him around the world. He's an incredible entrepreneur. And effectively finding management teams, being the CEO initially for the business, I wouldn't raise the capital. He would do that. But sometimes creating the business models with him. So we built a lot of e-commerce businesses. We built the biggest online fashion company in Australia, which is called The Iconic, which is run by a super smart guy called Patrick Smith today, who's done an incredible job. We built something called Lazada, which we then hired a CEO called for Max Bittner and sold the business later on. After I left, they sold the business to Alibaba for a little over $1 billion.
Wow.
And a lot of other companies. And then 2012, I said, look, I want to do this on my own. So I set up my holding company. I started building my own businesses. And the first business I built was a digital marketing company, which a few years later we sold for $15 million. It was the biggest digital marketing company at the time in Southeast Asia. We sold it to the biggest online marketing agency in Japan that wanted to expand outside of Japan. It's about 170 people by the time we sold it. I think it's a much bigger business today. They've done a great job on that. I built a recruiting firm, which we have still today, together with a great entrepreneur called Anne-Christine Group. I build a financial comparison business, which compares financial products. So we effectively do what Kayak does for flights. We do for hotels.com does for hotels. We do for financial products, insurance, banking, telco. We do that in 12 markets, 7 markets in Asia, 4 markets in Europe and Mexico. We've done that. We've raised about $120 million, I think, for that business so far from Goldman Sachs, Alibaba, the World Bank, et cetera, et cetera. I founded a business that's called Bendigo, which does point-of-sale financing together with a great guy called Jamie Morton, which does basically offers home improvement financing for contractors so that contractors can offer financing to their customers. I built a a bunch of educational companies within conferences. I now starting to build restaurants. The meeting I had before was looking at going into real estate, etc. So effectively, you know, the areas of business that I'm interested in today is I'm interested in financial services first and foremost. That's my everyday life. And then my weekends, I try to invest in, you know, looking into education. I try to look into, you know, the possibility of good things in business services. I try to look at, you know, how I can, you know, be smarter around food and beverage. Mm-hmm. So that's my life, you know, in short. And I love what I do. And I work with fantastic people.
That's an amazing story, Mass. I've got a load of questions for you, but I first want to ask how old you are now.
I'm 33 years old.
33. Okay, cool.
Maybe 34 by the time this comes out.
I definitely want to ask about your time management with all these adventures that you've been involved in. But one thing I noticed when you were telling your story is that you have an incredible drive that started even when you were 11 years old, you know, when you were first investing in stocks. And do you know about what about yourself gives you that drive? Was there a moment? Is this a natural thing that you have always had? Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, so I think the biggest drive that I have comes from, I think, the fact that as a kid, I was not a nerd and I wasn't a cool kid, which meant that I thought I was a cool kid, but I don't think the other kids thought so. And so I, in the schoolyard, wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be part of the cool kids. I wanted kids to follow me, and they didn't. They did it when I was in kindergarten, but they didn't after. And so it wasn't easy, because if I'd accepted that I wasn't cool, or, you know, people wouldn't follow me, it would have been a lot easier. I always thought I deserved better relationships, and I always thought I was to some degree misunderstood and people didn't get me and all those things. And I think part of me just wants to be loved and liked, you know, part of me just wants the admiration of people. Right. I mean, I think that's a really big driver for me. I think in many ways, many of us are just, you know, still kids in the schoolyard trying to not get bullied, trying to be liked, trying to be loved and all those things. And it's funny because I have parents who are extremely loving. They don't have any expectation to me whatsoever. I think, you know, if I burp today, I think my mom's still proud of me. You're like, oh, good boy, you know. So I don't have any of that from home. But I think I got it in school. And I think because I changed schools, not because I was a bad kid or anything, my mom wanted a better school for me. And so I changed school 3 times. And, you know, it was tough getting into those classes. It was tough finding my place in each of those classes. And I think that's it. And the same thing in high school, you know, I felt it difficult to fit in. And so that's what I want. I want to have friends today. You know, I want the admiration of people, et cetera. And I guess that's what I'm still looking for. And the irony is, you know, you'll never be happy and satisfied with it. So that's why I try to make sure now I enjoy every day.
Right.
Because it's an ever moving target. There will always be somebody and a lot of people who dislike me. And, you know, there will always be, you know, some people who love me. And, you know, I just got to live with that.
That's amazing that you're aware of that yourself, because I think a lot of people will go on this drive, this ambitious drive their entire lives and never recognize, you know, what is actually motivating them. But it's amazing that you know, because then you can understand what it is and how to regulate it. So kudos to you for that.
And I'm stuck between these two things, which is on one side, I want everyone to like me. And it's really tough. Like I can go to a conference, like I sometimes think VCs talk about me negatively in one way or another at a conference or something. And I just, you know, I'm not that fucking important. Nobody gives a shit about talking about it. Like, it just doesn't even make sense, even if I had to be super negative, right? So I interpret negatively on those things because I'm insecure about it. So, but on the other hand, I don't want to back down from a fight. So when people are trying to screw me, or when people are, you know, when I think going left is the correct thing and everybody else is saying right, I will fight, you know, to the end of the world to go left unless somebody convinces me otherwise, even though that means losing those relationships. So I'm actually happy I have it that way, because I don't want to, like, if you build a business and if you want to be successful in life, you have to have, like, there are going to be people who hate you. Whenever I'm out speaking at conferences, I have this chart that says impact on the world in one X and then a direct correlation on the other end to people pissed off, right? I love that chart. People always laugh. And I think you can, you know, and on one end you have nobody pissed off, you're watching kittens and YouTube on your pants, right? And then the other end, you're a famous rock star and president of the earth, right? And I, you know, that's just the truth. So I've come to live with the fact, or I'm trying to live with the fact, that I want to be the fighter. I want to do what I think is right. and I'm not going to be loved by everyone that's part of doing that. And by the way, I'll do a lot of wrong decisions in that path. My decision, no, by no means right, but I'll have to do the best that I believe.
Can we talk a little bit more about that fighting mentality? Because I think it's really important. What are some ways? So say everybody's going right and you believe going left is the correct way. Maybe you have an example you can share. And when it seems like the whole world is just going down your throat of, no, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. What are some things that you do mentally or even physically or emotionally to keep that, I guess you could say, stability or will to go in the direction that you know or you feel is the right direction to go?
It's a good question. And I think, by the way, Chris, I think there's so many different personalities on that, right? So there'll be, let's use your example. So I want to go left, everybody else wants to go right. There are the people who will say, look, fuck all of you. Left is the right way. I know better. You're idiots, right?
Right.
I may at the maximum say that, but I will never think that. So in my mind, I'm going, man, I'm probably wrong. Am I right here? You know, I actually doubt myself a lot, right? Mm-hmm. But the truth is, I have to just make the best decision I can based on the information that I have, right? And so I don't even have a good psychology behind it, because there'll be like, whether you don't even have to be a psychopath. You can just be very, you know, strong in your self-belief to feel actually completely okay about it. I don't feel okay. I feel like shit when it happens. I feel like shit when I'm sitting in a boardroom and six other board members think the opposite of me and who are really smart people and people I admire and people whose opinion I like. And they look down at me the minute I say, look, we should go left, and I fight for that and everything else, and I destroy relationships and, you know, all those things. And I have to look at the, you know, I have to be better sometimes, look at the big picture on that. But it's just like, what else am I going to do? I got here because I fight for what I believe in. And so I have to lose some battles and then I have to gain other ones. So I guess I try to look at the outcome of trying to follow everybody all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm in the position that I'm in because I'm either right more than I'm wrong, or because I'm better correcting when I'm wrong, you know, than I am correcting when I'm right. So I end up being right. And, you know, a lot of things can be reversed, by the way, right? So it's not like, you know, if I make a wrong hiring mistake, my rest of my team says, look, we shouldn't hire the guy. And I says, look, I think we should. And I go ahead with that. You know, it's not like I can't change it after. There are very few things in the world that's not changeable or irreversible, if you want. So I'm here because I believe in it. If I'm going to be believing in everybody else the rest of my life, you know, and them being right, then I should just give my money to them, and then I should look the other way and just follow orders, right? But I'm in the position that I'm in to do that. But again, it's really important for everybody listening to understand, it's not like I have the psychology to do this. I feel like shit internally every single time.
Yeah.
It's like going on stage. You know, every time I go on stage, I probably spoke at 50, 60 conferences last year. Every time I go on stage, I don't know if I can say this on your podcast, but I go to the bathroom before. Like, mm-hmm. I have to run to the bathroom before because I'm really nervous. I don't want to give more details, but I am. And that's the case. But I don't want to be the guy who backs down from going on stage just because I get nervous, right? And then I stand there and then things get okay over time. And then the other thing, I guess, is find people. So here's the thing. So there is, you know, we've all been told, I think, a lie, which is we've been told diversity is good. I'm not talking about diversity of colors and all those things. You know, I'm not talking about diversity of genders. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, we've been told that diversity is good, meaning if you want to go left and I want to go right, that's a great thing. I think generally you need to have people around the table who wants to run the same direction. Because when you're an entrepreneur and you're building a business, you can't fight every single time you have a decision to make.
Yeah.
So we like to say same goals, culture, and beliefs, but different skills. So what that effectively means is we're all running roughly in the same direction. One of us is a really good people person. Somebody else is really good with numbers. Somebody else is a sniper. Somebody else is kicks in the door. All those things, right?
Yeah.
But we have to be running in the same direction. And so I've had partners in my companies who I am fundamentally disagreeing with on almost every decision. And that drains me, in particular because of the way I think about things. And so I try to spend time with people who maybe look at the world with a different lens, but roughly are trying to achieve the same thing that I'm trying to achieve with a similar set of beliefs and cultures.
So amazing answer, by the way. I have another question, and so I'm going to change the direction just a little bit. But
sure.
Many entrepreneurs that I talk today, especially location independent entrepreneurs, there's two different kind of mentalities or camps of people that go to business school and then apply their knowledge in the real world and use the assets they learn from there to apply. And then there's a lot of people that say, don't go to business school. If you know you want to be an entrepreneur, go out and hustle and start the business ASAP. So you have any experience of business school? I actually went to business school also myself. I'm curious, what do you feel that you have gained from that, and especially a school like MIT? What do you feel that you have gained from those experiences that maybe helped catapult you to where you are today?
Okay, I think it's a great question, and I think it's actually really difficult. I'm going to give you, I think it's a very difficult answer, okay. Because I think if you don't, like, let's take university in general. Like, should you even go to university in the first place, right? I think it's a problematic thing to answer, because I think in some ways you don't have to, but I think if you don't want to, you should do it. Okay. So what do I mean by that? For example, like, I think McKinsey, the management consulting firm, is one of the best training grounds you have in the world, which is not a university, right? I think it's fantastic. It focuses on your development, focus on all those things. But if you really fit into McKinsey, I'm actually afraid for you as an entrepreneur, because it's a very safe environment. It's very, they say it's meritocratic. It's not completely, but you know, I think the best thing you can do is to go to McKinsey if you don't fit in effectively, because you'll learn a bunch of things that you actually need. If you fit into McKinsey, you're probably better off going maybe to Goldman Sachs, because they're a bit more wild and crazy, and you know, they're a bit more goal oriented, and they're a little bit more, you know, aggressive commercially and hustling a bit more than, you know, we do at McKinsey, where everything's a lot more proper. And so, in the same thing, it's almost like, do you have to go and do an MBA? Do you even have to go to university? I think there's, first of all, what do you learn in university? You learn to think. You learn to show up on time. You learn to work with people and deliver what you've agreed. You learn a lot of the personal skills that is going to help you for a lifetime. And for those reasons, I think it's worth going to university. I don't think it matters what you study. Now, the second thing is, if you don't want to go to university, even though I've just said those things, you have a problem which relates to the marshmallow test, right? So the marshmallow test, for everybody who's listening, is this test where a bunch of kids was offered a marshmallow, and they were told that if they don't eat the marshmallow, then 20 minutes later, they would get another marshmallow. And it turned out that the people who didn't eat the marshmallow and waited 20 minutes did much better in life, because of what is normally referred to as grit or self-discipline, right? Which is basically the ability to postpone immediate desires for later term gain. So sometimes when the guy says, look, I want to be an entrepreneur for my life, and I say, look, the smartest thing based on your personality you can do is to join McKinsey for 2 years. And the guy says, well, I think it's going to be boring. I says, yes, but this is what's going to allow you to do this for the next 60 years of your life. The more the guy doesn't want to do it, the more I'm afraid of the marshmallow test, the more I'm afraid he doesn't have the grit, the discipline to do something that's tough for 2 years, 1 year, to get the reward. So I guess it's a really long way of saying, look, I think fundamentally university, business school, et cetera, is great because of what it teaches you about how to interact and how to show up, et cetera. I don't think it's a must to be successful at all. I think people can do it without it. But I do think that the less you want to do it, the more you probably should do it. And I do think you meet an incredible amount of group of people around you. I have quite an alternative take sometimes on things. So that's my take.
Oh, I like it. And I know you provided quite a few examples of you doing that yourself throughout your youth and in college. But what are some ways that you currently, like maybe even on a day-to-day basis, or new projects or new businesses come up, what are some ways that you put yourself into difficult situations and know the right difficult or challenging situation to put yourself in?
Yeah. So I think fundamentally, by the way, that nothing is more important for success than grit or the self-discipline. I think many studies have proven that if you look at, you know, whether you go to West Point, you know, so the military university of the US, you know, nothing predicts performance better than self-discipline. The amazing thing about self-discipline is it's a muscle. That's both good and bad. That means you can train the muscle to be a bit better, but the more you use it, the weaker it gets on the very short run. So I think in life, we're presented by a billion opportunities to train self-discipline and get a benefit from it. Easiest example, every morning when you take a shower, you and I both know that taking a cold shower in the morning is great. You feel fantastic afterwards. It extends your lifetime. It's healthy for you. And you train self-discipline. So then the question is, why doesn't people do it? Is it because they don't know how to flick the thing? Probably not. I mean, everyone can turn on the cold tap. I mean, it's not that difficult, right? But that's self-discipline, right? They're saying, I want the benefit. Am I willing to take the short-term discomfort to get it? And so I think we're presented around it all the time. I think we have it when we have to choose our lunch. Am I going to have a salad today? Am I going to have a burger? We know which one is better for us in the long run, right? We have it when we, you know, when we're together with our girlfriend or boyfriend. Are we going to be on the phone or are we going to actually be present and have a conversation with them? We know which of those two develops a better relationship, right?
Right.
And so we have it all around us, not even work-related, the opportunity to train self-discipline. Now, the one one thing I would say is the more we train that muscle, like going to the gym, the bigger we'll get over time, but the weaker it will get on the day. So we have to be aware that when we use our self-discipline muscle on a day, we don't have unlimited of it. So you have to be selective around when you use it over time. Oh, sorry, on a day when it matters, but over time, you just have to focus on training and making it bigger.
Makes sense. I'm curious, you mentioned the book, The 4-Hour Workweek, and I think quite a few of the entrepreneurs that have been on the show have mentioned it, and that book has influenced their life in one way or another. And you talked about, at first reading the book, you thought it was stupid to work more, and you wanted to be more effective to create better businesses, or at least businesses that take less of your time. But and then you mentioned now that you're working all the time and you absolutely love it. So a lot of our entrepreneurs, location independent entrepreneurs, are people that even though if they have 7-figure plus, even 8-figure businesses, they may hang out in Saigon or Hong Kong or Thailand, you know, or Barcelona, and just kind of live an easy life. But I'm curious, what specifically did you learn from the 4-Hour Workweek that helps you apply into running your businesses today? Because you've started over 20 of them and you've had a bunch of other things going on. And from somebody that's in that world, that is almost like a different world for a lot of the location independent entrepreneurs. What are the things that you apply from that book in your current life and business?
Well, I think actually, and it's interesting, you know, when you listen to Tim Ferriss afterwards, right? And I think also his realization, how he's developed, I think he's realized that he doesn't work 4 hours a week, right? He just has the possibility to do so.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm sure Tim Ferriss, if you ask his mom, she would say he works all the time. Just like my dad would say, I work all the time. But I use the word work because it's the word that everybody uses. It's only work when I have to read a 50-page contract for the 50th time, right?
Okay.
When I deal with shit people that I don't want to deal with, then it's work. When I'm hanging out with my friends, like just before, you know, you and I spoke, you know, I was, you know, discussing a new business model with someone. That's not work. That's fun. Like, that's what I want to do. I don't want to go to the movies. I want to do that, right? So I think the first and foremost thing for me is do things you love. And I remember this example in the book, and mind you, it's now, you know, 12 years ago since I read it. But I remember this example said, if you're thinking about retirement, that means you're not doing what you love to do every single day.
Good point.
If I had the choice, Chris, I would play football every single day for probably 4 or 5 hours a day. I don't have the choice. I only play football 3 times a week or so. But I try to play as much as I humanly can because I, you know, my legs can't handle 5-7 days a week. Unfortunately, I'm, you know, 33 now. But you know, do what you love to do. Like if you're still worried about saying, look, I want to live in Barcelona, I want to work 4 hours a day and I want to make money, that's fine. But then realize you actually have a job and I don't, right? If you say, look, I want to do this 80 hours a week, right? You know, I have some other interests, I have, you know, other things I think that's fun, but you know, I want to do this 60 hours a week, then you're doing something probably you love. If you're saying, look, I'm not getting a return on my time, but I'm doing this because it's fucking fun, then you're doing what I do. I feel much worse for the guy who works 4 hours a week or 4 hours a month who, you know, who doesn't love what he does than for myself, because this is what I want to do every day.
A question about the effectiveness of starting new businesses. I've noticed a lot of entrepreneurs after they build their first business, or even in the middle of building their first business, they're ready and excited to start a new project. And you've had an incredible amount of success by getting an idea up and running and going, and then letting the baby go to grow. So how do you, when you have a new idea for a business, what are the steps that you take to decide if it's a good idea and then implementing it and then creating an actual full-on business and to the point to where you let it go and you let it grow on its own?
Okay. So two parts to the answer. So the first one is thinking about the business model, right? Which is in Silicon Valley, there is a belief, which is that it's all about the team, right? It's all about if you have a great team, you know, things will work itself out. I personally think business model is much more important. because I think, and I've seen mediocre people become billionaires on great business models. I have seen great people not even become millionaires on bad business models. And the amazing thing about business models is, you know, you have something called the efficient market hypothesis about stocks, which effectively says that, you know, stocks and bonds and everything is price correct at any given point in time. Business models are not. There are great business models. There are bad business models. There are business models you can kill in a second on the back of an envelope. And there are business models that, you know, are completely overlooked, where the market is, doesn't want to do it because of X, Y, Z reason, because it's unsexy, because it's not hot, because of whatever, right? And I think there's so many cases of completely undervalued business model, if you want to use a sort of equity markets example. So I think the first thing is spend a lot of time thinking about the business model. Don't throw yourself at the first business model that comes to mind. I've seen so many people who underestimate how much commitment that's required in a business model once they hire people to raise money. A lot of people say, well, you know, I'll hire these people, then I'll go and do something else. Most likely what will happen is you're stuck in that business for the next 5 to 10 years if you hire people, you raise money. So you got to be really sure about it. And you got to think about it like a friend of mine has written a book, which is a fantastic book called The Goldmine Effect. And also another book called Hunger in Paradise. This is a highly recommended book, particularly The Goldmine Effect. He now runs 2 football teams in Europe. Very successful football teams leading their respective leagues. And he says one of the biggest mistakes when football clubs chooses players is they look at the player in the context of the league that he plays in rather than as a whole pool. So what does that mean? That means you look at a player and you'll say, wow, this guy's playing the Norwegian first division, best league. He's an amazing player. I can see he's dribbling around everyone, etc. What Rasmus does is he takes that player and he imagines he played in the league of every club in the world. Every club played in the same league. How would that guy perform? And what you find very often, for example, and this is what he does, he buys players from the second best German division, for example, to play in Denmark, because it turns out that the second best German division is the players are better than a lot of the players that is in the best Danish division, for example. The same thing goes for business models. Put every business model in a league. Every business model should play against each other and then choose the best business model for you based on expected return, how much fun you think, what the risk is, do you have the time, do you have the right competencies, et cetera, for that business model. So that's in choosing the business model, which I think is extremely important. The second part of your question is, should you do multiple businesses, right? And I'm going to be the first guy to say you should never do multiple businesses. Mm-hmm. I think your time is much better spent doing one business over doing 20 businesses. And then you're going to say, well, Mass, that's counter argument to what you do. Absolutely. That's because I'm not the best CEO. If I was the best CEO to run a business, I should run our comparison businesses, which compares these financial products. It's an amazing business model. We have fantastic investors. We have a really, really, really good team. And if I was the best CEO, I should do that. We have much better CEOs running the business. So I'm playing the best position on the team that I can play and letting other people play the best position that they can. But if you as a listener are saying, I'm actually a good CEO, I would say develop that business, grow it, make it bigger, add revenue streams to your current product, add new customer groups. You know, if you want, add employees, don't add employees, whatever you want to do. That would be my advice. And most business models out there that any listener will be doing right now has the potential way above and beyond what they're realizing today.
I like that advice. I wanted to ask you first some resources or books that people could use to improve current business models or recognize where and if their business model is a good, sustainable, solid business model.
Lavin, you have to say our own first because we gathered all the advice that we can, right? So we've written a book called Entrepreneur from Startup to Success. And it's not like it could have been written by someone else or recommended it still. It's just a book that takes you A to Z on how to build a company. And we've just gathered everything from every book that we've read, over 100 articles and books that we read to just write the book. But I think the other ones that come out is Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz, which I think is a fantastic book. And really partially just shows entrepreneurs how difficult it is, even for one of the most successful entrepreneurs and investors in the world. I really like a book that's has what I would call a very American title, which is called How to Double Your Profits in 6 Months or Less, which is a book of basically 50 different ideas for how to increase your profitability of your business, I think is really good. I give a bunch of books that I give as presents to people when they come to our office beyond our own. I have another book that's called Memos from the Chairman, which is written by Ace Greenberg, who was the chairman of Bear Stearns for 30 years. He's not the reason why the bank unfortunately failed. He was there before, but it's a collection of his memos. And the takeaway from that book is really how important culture is and how you communicate to a group of people in a consistent way and keep them focused on what's important in the business. And then probably the last book I'm going to mention is perhaps the most important of all those books. And I'm sure other people have mentioned that on the show as well. If they haven't, I'll be the first. And many more will do it. But that's Principles, which is written by the biggest hedge fund manager in the world called Ray Dalio. So Ray Dalio is one of the, I think, 300 richest guys in the world, runs a hedge fund called Bridgewater. And it's how he built Bridgewater as a systematic company. So basically, he says everything is an algorithm, whether it's in the computer, whether it's done between people, and he tries to write down principle that guides every decision that he makes. So basically try to automate people, automate decision-making effectively.
Excellent. So I'll give you one more question and we'll wrap up, Mass. For entrepreneurs over the next decade, what are some tips or suggestions you can give to them, specifically more digital online entrepreneurs, tips and suggestions you could give to them that if you predict or see any shifts in the market, how could they position themselves to be more secure, solid entrepreneurs over the next 10 years?
I think it's a great question because I think being more secure in the future becomes even more important. I mean, if you look at reality of what's happening right now, the gap between the rich and the poor is getting bigger, which is really unfortunate. Because of AI, because of robots, that gap is most likely going to get bigger, because if you're not on a team that can add value above and beyond AI and robots, you're going to be on the team below the AI and robots, and you're going to work for them. And you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be the guy who, you know, look, we don't want to put a robot in place here because it's too expensive. Let this person do the job. So I think that becomes very important. The second reason why I think it becomes important is because you right now have a couple of companies that are aggregating everything, right? Facebook, Google, Amazon, Alibaba, etc. And when you look at what's happening in Silicon Valley more and more and, you know, around the world, is those companies are either becoming the innovators or they're buying the innovators quite early on and developing the products in there. I mean, it's insane to think about, like, just Alibaba and Amazon, how many different areas of business they're executing on and winning at the same time. So you're getting these almost monopolistic platforms. And so for you to, you know, add value in the market becomes even more important. So I guess the first thing I would say is I would try to stay either far away from what those guys are doing right now, or I would try to add value in a way that I would make sure they cannot. More personal touch, focus on a niche product, solving a particular niche or demand in a better way. The second thing I would say is I would look at, as always, at ways to add massive value to people. Like, understanding your customers and adding value becomes just so much more important in the future. Do you speak enough to your customers? Do you listen enough to them? Do you, you know, innovate together with your customers? Do you have their input in mind with everything that you do? Do you even let sometimes your customers build your products for you? And I guess the third thing is, and I think it's linked to the second thing, is, you know, make sure you build your tribe for your business and your brand. And I think the brand part is going to be even more important, but make sure you have a loyal group of followers who want to walk through fire for this particular product or service. So you really, you know, make sure that you have a place in the market in the future.
Excellent. Amazing answers. We're going to wrap up there. I wanted to mention again, you guys have the book that was just released for the second time in 23 countries around the world, Entrepreneur Building Your Business from Start to Success, Danish Financial Times Top 5 book, correct?
Correct, globally, cool. Exactly. And now okay. It's in English.
Good. So check out that book. Mass, again, thank you so much for your time, your tips, your tricks, and all your wisdom that you shared. If the listeners want to reach out and learn more about what you have going on, where's the best place they can do that at?
Just go to LinkedIn is probably the best way. I'll share as much information there as I can.
Cool. Sounds good. Again, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to wrap it there. And listeners, thank you guys for tuning in once again. And we'll see you all on the next episode. Goodbye, everybody. Hey, listeners, thanks for joining us once again. We wanted to remind you about our high performance productivity coaching and our annual Get Shit Done live retreat in Thailand. Both are designed for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs to get a lot of work done rapidly. And whether you need some personal coaching while working away at home or a retreat in Thailand where you can get out of your normal routine and surround yourself with other successful entrepreneurs, we have those options for you. Check out all the details at thebusinessmethod.com, and we'll see you on the next podcast.